right, we'll return to the argument calendar. The next case for argument is Padilla versus Gonzalez. Ms. Fasciati.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Mary Fasciati, and I represent the petitioner appellant in this action that seeks review of the district court's order dismissing a petition for writ of habeas corpus that was premised on the fact that the removal order was no longer valid because the state conviction had been vacated, the two state convictions had been vacated that previously supported the removal order. The case presents a Gordian knot of entanglements that, and may I say this as a parenthetical statement of my own position in this, having long been in this field, that the more Congress tries to reform, the less reform we get. And so what we have now is a layered statute that has the Real ID Act as a jurisdictional bar, and then you have the IRA-IRA and its provisions that supposedly bar jurisdiction. But fortunately for at least me in this case, the appellees have said that the court should take jurisdiction of this case on direct review from the district court's denial of habeas corpus, but it should deny for lack of jurisdiction because this case is foreclosed by a former case relating to Mr. Padilla, and for practical purposes, it's Padilla 1, which was decided in February of last year. Padilla 1 dealt with the fact that whether the obstruction of justice conviction, which Mr. Padilla had, was a crime involving moral turpitude, and this court held, in deciding that it had jurisdiction to consider its jurisdiction, it held that it was not. It was a crime involving moral turpitude. And on that basis, the removal order became final. Subsequently, Mr. Padilla secured a state court vacator order vacating both convictions. And it is that order that was before Judge Duryagian when he sat as a district court judge. We contend that Judge Duryagian came to the merits of the case. He specifically said, not that he didn't have jurisdiction, but he denied the petition based on an administrative decision called Matter of Pickering, which I have argued rather strenuously in my briefs is wrong. And it's wrong because, as I indicate in my briefs, that it implicates the full faith and credit, Title 28 U.S.C., Section 1728, which requires a federal court, sitting as a federal court, to give full faith and credit to a state court judgment, such as the case here, where the state court judgment vacates a previous conviction. Judge Duryagian said he was bound by Matter of Pickering. Matter of Pickering is a case where the Board of Immigration Appeals said that we don't have to give full faith and credit to a state court judgment vacating the conviction if it was done solely for immigration purposes. It has to be done, said the board, on the basis of an error of a substantive and procedural errors underlying the criminal proceedings. What were those substantive and procedural errors? The board didn't say. But up to this point, immigration judges have been wrestling with the issue, is this vacator or this dismissal of the conviction or this reversal of the conviction after the fact, does this really mean that the conviction is null and void and therefore cannot be used as the evidentiary basis in a removal proceeding? Because what basically the conviction record is a piece of evidence that says this person was convicted of a crime, and if the crime is such that it fits the Immigration Act for grounds of removability, grounds of deportability, then the matter is closed. So the question is, what happens when a state court decides after the fact that it might have made a mistake or that the alien did not get a fair day in court and his plea of guilty was either A, misunderstood, didn't speak English, didn't understand, was forced, or he didn't understand that the consequences of entering that plea of guilty would be deportation. In the case of aggravated felons, it's absolute deportation. When we have the IRA-IRA Act that says that you can go back in time to convictions that preceded the effective date of IRA-IRA, like by some 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and you can use those as a predicate for subsequent order removal, well, then you have some problems. Aliens are coming forward saying, gee, I didn't know that happened. Oh, my God, nobody told me about that, which might have been the case here. But nonetheless, the board says that we don't want to recognize those vacator orders unless they involve some procedural or substantive defect. well, if we're going back 10 years and nobody understood the consequences of a plea of guilty in a criminal case on a person's immigration status, and fortuitously this person wasn't picked up and put into removal proceedings for 10 or 15 years, well, then we have an issue as to whether or not there was a defect in the proceedings going back in time. It seems a little hypocritical to me, however, to argue that we can go back in time retroactively when we're talking about a conviction that might support a removal order, but we can't go back in time where we're challenging a conviction based on a statute enacted in Illinois in 2004 that obliges courts to specifically warn of the consequences of deportation on a defendant's alien status.
But that statute is effective January 1st, 2004, and requires that warning at the time of a plea. And your client's plea was entered in October of 89, if I'm not mistaken? So why would a statute effective in 2004 become a retroactive application?
First of all, it's a procedural rule. I don't think it's a rule of substantive law. This is my interpretation of the 2004 statute. That's number one.
What
procedural rules can be retroactively applied backwards in time. Substantive rules do not. I also contend that any court might have had the right to vacate a conviction if that individual did not speak English and if there were other paramount reasons such as the inability to...
That's not what was done here. What was done here is a motion was made on the basis of this new statute. Your analysis about procedural rules versus substantive rules is the analysis that applies to retroactivity of judicial decisions, not the retroactivity of statutes. This is a new statute. It's expressly made effective prospectively, as most statutes are. And so why there was any basis for the state court to vacate this conviction, I do not know. Now, the question of whether we should look behind that is another one, but you know, the basis of the vacature order is flawed.
That is assuming that that was the only basis for the vacator order.
That's the only basis in the motion.
Well, the basically what the court said is that we have heard the arguments of counsel, the person is an alien, and he was not advised of the consequences. Now, what happened at the hearing. I don't know if it was a...
But can I just stop just for a moment? There's no reason to believe that the Illinois statute here is retroactive. There's nothing that would indicate that it would be retroactive. I just want to...
I think I cited the statute of statutes as to whether or not my position was that it could be conceivably applied retroactively because the statute of statutes under Illinois law would suggest that it could be because it is a procedural, it's a type of a procedural situation that does not necessarily impugn the validity of the conviction or the validity of the plea. The validity of the conviction.
But that's really a stretch, isn't it? I mean, I saw that argument in your briefs, but you don't really have a lot of authority. I understand your argument, how you're trying to build your argument to that point, but I don't see that as a very strong position.
Well, even if, let's assume, Your Honor, that and I appreciate the fact that the court sees where I'm trying to go with that. I mean, obviously, I only have a certain amount of elevation with that argument, and I acknowledge that. But if a court decides in Illinois that it has jurisdiction, that the parties are before it, and that there is a petition to vacate the conviction based on involuntariness of the plea of guilty, and in this case, the allegation was section the 2004 statute, Is it necessary for the district court to have disallowed that based on a non-retroactivity principle, or whether the district court was required to give it full faith and credit as a legitimate state judgment? For one thing, the parties before the state court consisted of the defendant and the state's attorney. If the state's attorney didn't like what was happening, he could have objected to that, and the circuit court would have had to listen to the state's attorney. In fact, my experience is that circuit courts listen to state's attorneys. And if there's an objection, they probably won't rule in favor of the defendant. It's not that often, in my experience, that happens to be the case. But let's assume that this circuit court was sufficiently sorrowful over this man's status and said, well, we're going to vacate the conviction. I think that there's reason to vacate it. Isn't that enough to permit full faith and credit if the parties before the court were proper parties and if the issue was decided and if the court had jurisdiction, subject matter, and in personam jurisdiction, wouldn't that be enough? I suggest to the court that it would be.
Why didn't you take this argument to the agency?
Because
we're not reviewing. Even if we construe this habeas as a petition for review, what are we reviewing?
Nothing. You're reviewing the district court's decision dismissing the petition for habeas corpus on the grounds it refused to recognize the state court judgment. Now, about going to the agency. There is a 90-day rule on motions to reopen for presentation of new evidence. That 90-day rule had passed. It is a jurisdictional rule that supports the notion of finality.
So he couldn't have filed a motion to vacate either after the January 1st date, which was when the statute went into effect? Couldn't he have filed a motion to reopen?
In 2004?
Right. After the...
I'm not sure. To be very honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know that he was in deportation proceedings in 2004. I'm not quite certain of that fact.
Because that would have some bearing, because if he could have filed a motion after January 1st, that would have allowed him to file a timely motion to reopen in May of 2004, and then we wouldn't have had the time problem.
According to my statement of facts, now that I recollect this, the Homeland Security instituted removal proceedings on September 23, 2003, when he sought admission to the United States as a returning resident alien by presenting his green card, and that's when his criminal convictions arose.
So you're saying then he could not have filed a motion to reopen because that hadn't been
because
concluded?
The case was pending.
Because it was still pending.
And based on the pendency of that case, there were issues relating to whether or not there was a bunch of appeals that went back and forth. There was issues relating to they charged five grounds involving moral turpitude,
right.
Two of which were dismissed. The board, it went to the board and then went back. So in reality, this case had been around the block a number of times on issues that had some very substantial quality to them.
Well, what prevented him from filing a motion to reopen in May of 2005 after the sentences had been vacated?
The 90-day rule. There is a 90-day rule in the federal statute, 8 U.S.C. section 1229 B.C., that says that you can't file a motion to reopen unless that motion is within 90 days of the last administrative order.
And there's no grounds to do it for changed circumstances or exceptional circumstances.
The changed circumstance rule is a subsection of that statute, and it really relates to asylum cases where the asylee is asking for a new kick at the cat based on the asylum application and changed country conditions. What was at issue here, and the district court asked the DHS, will you agree to a joint motion to reopen? And under those circumstances, the 90-day rule is waived. But DHS refused to join in a joint motion to reopen. And so the Mr. Padilla was stuck, not being able to have any recourse to the administrative agency, the Board of Immigration Appeals, to test whether or not the vacator of his conviction fulfilled, essentially removed or affected the validity of the deportation order.
Is there anything that prevented him from bringing his motion in the state court to vacate the convictions earlier?
Well,
so that he would have been within the 90-day
rule? One could surmise, this court decided his case in February of 2005. And
But nothing in the interim after the law that the motion to vacate was based on was effective, which was January 1st of 2004, prevented him from moving the state court for the benefit of that law.
We're going back to 2003 when the proceedings were instituted through a long process of administrative proceedings to the Board of Immigration Appeals on issues that did not relate to the validity of the underlying validity. And one can suppose he might have been able to do that, but essentially there were a number of administrative issues on which he could have had a reasonable expectation that would be ruled in his favor.
Why does any of that make a difference? The law that he now seeks the benefit of and sought the benefit of in the state court was effective January 1st of 2004, and he waits until after all of his removal proceedings are final and litigated in full in this court, to go back to the state court to try to get those vacated. And then he makes this argument that a law that is on its face prospectively effective should be given retroactive effect to him, and gets the state court to buy that, and now we're supposed to give that full faith and credit.
My time is up. Should I answer that question?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You're not getting out of it that easy.
My position is this. Finality with respect to a removal order is different than finality with respect to the validity of a criminal conviction for whatever reason. And the full faith and credit clause would require a federal court to accept the decision of the state court unless there was some issue as to its jurisdiction.
It's not a question of the finality of his convictions.
Well,
his convictions were final
issue,
in 1990 or 91.
But it is an issue as to the finality of the removal order. And that's what the court is raising here, is why didn't he do this before, when once we have a final order of removal, it should be a final order of removal for all time. And I'm saying that that is not really the case. If the evidence supporting that removal order is gone, tainted, or whatever, there should be an opportunity to raise that in a habeas corpus. Habeas corpus involves a collateral challenge to an otherwise final judgment. That's been the traditional definition. And habeas corpus was the proper vehicle in this case. The question is whether or not this court finds that finality is absolute for all purposes, and in which case, then obviously, the district court was correct. That's been my position on this. Thank you. I have a few minutes left, I think. After rebuttal.
By the grace of the court, you may have an opportunity. Mr. Oswald.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. I'm Craig Oswald on behalf of the United States. Going back from the timetable here in terms of trying to set a concept up for how this all worked, Mr. Padilla was convicted of these convictions in 1989-1991. He then left the country, came back in, and in 2000, he was placed into deportation proceedings. I believe that was in September. He then, the immigration judge, then issued a decision on his case in May of 2002, and the BIA ruled on his case on February 24th of 2004. So that was 24 days after this. You know, the statute took effect on February 1st of 2004. This was based on February 24th. So he could have filed a motion at that time. This court's decision in the case, which this court has already seen this case one time, was in February of 2005. Last year, and then after that, the motions to vacate these convictions are made in March of 2005, and the habeas is filed in May of 2005. So there is a long course here. I mean, and one of the issues here, as you pointed out, Your Honor, is what are you reviewing? This is a Real ID Act case. You have a petition for review. It's a review of an administrative record. What is the administrative record in this case? We would argue that you have an administrative record here that would be the same one that the court has already reviewed in Padilla 1, which is the removal order. This is obviously, they're claiming changed circumstances, but they have not presented those circumstances to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And the Board of Immigration Appeals in this case should have been where they pursued this. Their Board of Immigration Appeals was the body that issued the removal order. That then was appealed here. This court, in a lengthy decision, affirmed that, and they never went back to the board. Counsel argues in her briefs that there is a set of cases where there's an exception where you don't have to administratively exhaust. But the cases that there's a Wang case from the Fifth Circuit, there's a Luis case from the First Circuit that talks about the sua sponte authority of the board to reopen these cases. And it is, one presents, the regulation provides for this, that if you want the board to look at your case, you can seek reopening. And if the board, in exercising its sua sponte authority, abuses its discretion, this court obviously can review that and can reverse that. But you have to let them look at this. All the discussion about Pickering and the discussion about the full faith and credit, I think that that's an interesting discussion and a number of things. I think it's irrelevant to this case at this time in this setting, because that needs to go to the board, and the board needs to thrash those issues out if you have that case. In this case, she argues that this should be full faith and credit. I mean, we have here a situation in which 15 years goes by, and basically Mr. Padilla does nothing about these criminal convictions. They're all sitting there. We've litigated this case before the board. We've litigated this case before this court. And then only a month after this court issues its decision do they do something about it. And they go in based upon this 2004 statute, which explicitly is prospective in nature and has no retroactive effect whatsoever, and say, go to a state court judge who, you know, from all the order in this case is a handwritten out order from a state court judge 15 years afterwards, with a state's attorney who we have a letter from, who talks about who doesn't know anything about the case, presumably, as his letter says, because when they say, well, why, you know, what happened here was the district court denied the habeas, then they said we were asking because we were concerned that there might be a constitutional violation here that they were alleging. For example, in Illinois, under Illinois law at the time, if a lawyer misadvised you of the immigration consequences of your guilty plea, that would be a constitutional violation. We would agree with that. We admitted in court. We said, if that's the case, if they told him that, don't worry, this won't matter, that you won't get deported if you plead guilty to this, and that turned out to be wrong, that obviously, it's not a voluntary guilty plea because he was misadvised of the consequences. And so we kept asking, well, what was the reason? Why was there a constitutional, what was the constitutional reason? And it kept going back to, and this was not Ms. Fischotti because she didn't have the case before the district court, but there was nothing other articulated other than the statute, which didn't apply 15 years before. And so you end up with a situation where the state's attorney said, they came in and we basically agreed to this motion, and the reason this was done was, one, statute of limitations problems. Obviously, it's 15 years afterwards. Are you going to re-prosecute the guy for something that he did 15 years before? Two, proof problems, which any prosecutor knows. How are you going to possibly find any of the witnesses that were involved? And he basically said, these issues were all, you know, evidentiary issues or things that we were worried about. The final thing was that we were worried that we had already been punished for this. Well, who would really re-prosecute that? What does that appear to be? Do you want to get, in this case, I think it shows why Pickering, which this court has affirmed already. I mean, in Ali versus Ashcroft, last year this court said that Pickering is got the endorsement of this court to the extent that this is a correct law. So to the extent that counsel is arguing Pickering is overruled, she's arguing that this court should re-examine that precedent, and I don't think she can do that in this context. And, you know, so therefore I would say that you can't say that Pickering was incorrectly decided when you look at this case, which is 15 years goes by. The BIA looks at this case. This court looks at this case, and then counsel goes into a state court judge, walks in with a piece of paper, and then walks into district court, not even giving it back to the body that issued the order, and says, hold the presses, stop, you know, you can't deport me, and, you know, don't even ask me why I waited so long, because here's my piece of paper, and you can't go beyond this record. This is presented to the wrong authority. And at this time, it should have been gone back to the BIA. The district court correctly decided this case, and we asked this court to affirm this and to dismiss this case.
All right, thank you, Mr. Oswald. Ms. Fasciata, your time has expired, but you may have a minute if you wish.
I would like to address one question here. Going back to the transcript, the circuit court said that it had discretion to apply the statute retroactively, and I believe under Illinois law, if a statute, a judge has the discretion to apply a statute retroactively in the case of a procedural rule, and I'm citing the Illinois statute on statutes
5 ILCS 70-4. The question simply is whether or not this court can inquire as to whether or not the circuit court properly entered its order. And I don't think this court, I think we have to use the full faith and credit as the benchmark of what recognition are we going to give to a judgment where the court had jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the next case.